So why don't I get started right now and introduce our speaker. Go back. Okay. And then I'll press it to begin. Or you'll do it? Okay, great. So Jonathan Helmis received his PhD from Ohio State University in 2013 in chemical physics. He's the author of NMR Glue, the NMR Glue Python Library, as well as a contributor to a number of scientific Python packages, including SciPy, NumPy, and scikit-image. Currently, he's at Argonne National Laboratory outside of Chicago and holds the title of Advanced Algorithms Engineer. I'm really, really excited and happy to have Jonathan be able to start us off for the symposium this year and also to provide a core science keynote. And today, his talk... didn't flip the right page. His talk will be The Language, Libraries, and Culture of Python in Meteorology. So please join me in welcoming Jonathan.
All right. Well, thank you, Johnny, for the kind introduction. And I'd also like to welcome everyone to the sixth symposium on Python in atmospheric and oceanic sciences. So I'm going to be talking about Python and the language and libraries and the culture and why Python is really an excellent choice for writing software for meteorology. I am at Argonne National Lab, and I get to hold this really cool title of Advanced Algorithms Engineer. So before we get started in looking at Python, I want us to take a step back and kind of just look at technology and science. And I think some of the keynotes this morning really hit on the fact that scientific advancements and discoveries are really driven by technology. So one of the keynote speakers talked about his experience at the National Hurricane Center where they were sending up kites, which, you know, nowadays seems almost, you know, very silly when we have much more advanced technology. And throughout history, we've seen that state-of-the-art technology in the hands of scientists very quickly leads to very significant scientific breakthroughs and discoveries, which really help us to understand the world around us. Two examples are the experiments that went into discovering the structure of the atom. So J.J. Thomson was working with a new technology that allowed him to create very strong vacuums in glass tubes. And in the lab of Ernst Rutherford, they were shooting newly discovered alpha particles. And they luckily, he had a graduate student, Hans Geiger, who just happened to know how to detect alpha particles, and these led to the discoveries of the electron and the nucleus, which really was very significant and would not have been possible without the technology. And if we look at today's society, we notice that computers are really the prime technology available to scientists to perform science. And the ability to perform fast and accurate computations has really revolutionized meteorology, and I believe will continue to do into the near future. And so the keynotes did give some examples of some of what people see now. So we have buoys that are connected instead of having to send out balloon-borne radio sondes. And in my own research, which is focused on weather radar, we use computers to send out very highly timed and precise microwave pulses, which then are collected by computers after they reflect off the atmosphere, and then are processed and stored for later analysis. And none of this would have been possible without these this high-tech infrastructure. And even just in the past 30 years, the technology of computers has changed drastically. So this figure right here is from the first Journal of Atmospheric and Oceanic Technologies back in 1984, and this is a spectrograph, a real-time spectrogram of a Doppler spectra from an early radar wind profiler. And this is using ASCII symbols to represent the intensity of the return signal. And if we look at this, and it appears really antiquated today, where we have graphical things that we can actually, you know, zoom in and explore and probably even animate, and we can access those from all over the world. And all of this has been possible just with the advances in computer technology in the last 30 years. So I think it's fair to say that computers are really required for the operational, daily operations of science. Unfortunately, computers require very specific directions. They don't just work magically. And someone has to provide these instructions in the form of programs and software. And increasingly, the ability to create custom software to meet the specific scientific needs is an important task. Unfortunately, writing software is a time-consuming and burdensome task, and it really takes up a lot of a scientist's time. Some recent studies actually found that scientists estimate that 35% of their research time is spent developing software. Now, these were scientists in a number of different fields, but I think meteorology also sees a similar amount of time being spent on software development. This is really surprising, given that most scientists have no formal background in software engineering practices and typically learn to develop software informally from their peers. Because of these two factors, I really believe that the choice of programming language can really affect the amount of time required, but also the quality of software produced. And so I believe a number of people in this room find that Python is really the ideal programming language for writing scientific software. And this is due to a number of reasons, but I think three really key reasons are the design and philosophy that went into the language, the availability of a large number of high-quality and efficient scientific Python libraries, and finally, the welcoming and vibrant community that has grown up around Python. And so we're going to look in detail at all of these ideas. And I should warn you that we're going to, in a couple cases, really get into the nitty-gritty and nuts and bolts of some of these libraries. But I'm going to try and keep this talk so that there's something for both newcomers to Python and experienced Pythonistas. So what exactly is so special about Python? So Python is a high-level interpreted general-purpose language. So let's break this down a little. So Python is a high-level language. What this means is when you're writing in Python, you can focus on the computational tasks using strong abstractions of the data. This is in comparison to low-level languages where you have to worry about how the data is represented in memory and on disk, and also worry about allocating and controlling memory. So using a high-level language often makes development much quicker, and also there's typically fewer bugs in the final software. Python is also an interpreted language, so what this means is there's no compilation step, and this means this often speeds up the development cycle since code can be written and then instantaneously run after saving. Since it is interpretive, Python is also interactive. You can open up a shell and type Python statements and commands and get back the results right in front of you. And this also can help in testing and debugging. So if you have a software or a particular bug that you're having an issue, you can actually open an interactive shell in the middle of a program and examine the state of the interpreter. Finally, Python is general purpose. Now, this might seem a little strange to be a benefit because you'd think if we're writing scientific software, perhaps a domain-specific language that focused on science would be a better choice. But I actually believe that a general-purpose language is better because scientists often need to perform non-scientific tasks, like grabbing a file from the internet or popping up a window to get a parameter from a user. And having to write these in a second language would be quite burdensome and require additional learning. In addition, by using a general-purpose language, Python has a much larger user base. So the web development community uses Python quite often, and we get to benefit from the materials that they produce to learn and study Python, as well as the bugs that they fix in the language and features that they add. And this wouldn't be true of a more domain-specific language. Now, there are a number of high-level interpreted general-purpose programming languages like Perl and Ruby. So what really makes Python special for scientific work? I believe there's a few keys. So Python has a very concise and readable syntax. And part of this is really the design philosophy that went into Python and the realization that source code is more often read than it is written. And so being able to read source code and find bugs just by reading it is very important. If we look at this example, this is a really short little program written in Python that makes a list of three colors, loops over those colors, and then prints out that color on a new line. And we see in Python, this almost looks like pseudocode. There's very little extra syntax. There's maybe this semicolon here. But it's pretty readable. If we compare that to the same program written in Perl, we see that we need to use semicolons and brackets to delineate lines in blocks of text. We also have to use special symbols to access variables and to access the loop variable. And all of these add an unnecessary burden to our minds while we're programming. In addition, Python is open source, so we're not dependent on any software or any company for the continued development of the language. It's also free, so there's no need to manage licenses or pay licensing fees. And this can be extremely important when you're working on very large systems with tens or hundreds or even thousands of nodes, where the licensing costs might be quite prohibitive. Python also has a very large number of third-party libraries, so the Python package index is the official repository for these packages, and it contains more than 72,000 libraries, and many of these are focused on scientific topics. Finally, an important key feature of the language that's really important for science is that in Python, it's very easy to interface with C and C++ and Fortran libraries. Oftentimes in science, we approach a problem and we already have an existing library that has been written and tested for a number of years. And being able to reuse that in our language of choice, Python, it can be very important and speed up development. Now, with those things said, Python is not without some challenges. And a few of these are that Python is slow, especially compared to some compiled languages. Now, this isn't always a problem. There's a lot of computational tasks where speed is not of the utmost importance. If you're running a task a few times per day and it takes 1 or 2 seconds to do the analysis, it really doesn't make sense to rewrite that in something else to gain additional performance. And there also are a number of options that exist to speed up code, and we'll look at one of those options today, and I think there's a couple short tutorials on that in the next 2 days. Python as a language also is not great at certain types of parallel computations. The big hairy beast in this room on this topic is the global interpreter lock, or GIL, which you can Google about if you're interested. And this really poses some limits on multi-threaded performance in Python. Also, Python isn't great in handling certain types of concurrency, where some languages that were built on top of this, like Go or Erlang, are really nice. Finally, if you're going to do computations on very massively parallel systems or GPUs, you're going to have to use a third-party library like Numba or PyCuda in Python, whereas other languages might actually support this directly. It's also worth noting that the Python as a language is a little bit in flux currently. So a few years back, Python 3 was released, which is a backwards incompatible version of Python as compared to Python 2, which is still often used. And the community is still kind of uncertain which version of Python to use and recommend for new users. In addition, a lot of libraries do not yet support Python 3 and may not ever, just because of the additional time needed to port these libraries. So with those challenges in mind, I still think that Python is really an excellent language and a great choice for writing meteorological software. And a lot of this has to do with the libraries and the scientific libraries that are available for the language. A core set of these is often referred to as the Scientific Python Ecosystem, or SciPy stack. And some of the core packages in that stack are NumPy, SciPy, Matplotlib, Project Jupyter, which was previously known as IPython, as well as Pandas and SymPy. And we're going to be looking at all of these in detail, or at least, I guess, most of them in detail, as well as some other libraries. And we're going to be showing how these libraries can be used in code. And we're going to be taking examples from a project that I work on, which is the Python ARM Radar Toolkit, which is a library for visualizing, correcting, and analyzing weather radar. The development of PyArt began to meet the needs of the Atmospheric Radiation Measurement Program, with the acquisition of a number of scanning cloud and precipitation radars. Since then, the project has expanded and now works with a variety of radars, including NEXRAD, and also has extended its user base to include radar researchers, weather enthusiasts, and climate modelers. PyArt is available on GitHub. It's open source software. You can learn more about it at that address. And if you want to install it and have a slightly easier way, there are Conda packages available on the Anaconda Cloud under my channel, JJ Helmus. So the first library that I want to look at is NumPy, which is really the fundamental and core library in all of scientific computation in Python. The other scientific Python libraries in both the SciPy stack and others really build upon NumPy to add additional features and ability. If NumPy is the core, then the most important part of NumPy is the powerful and efficient multidimensional array object, or the NVArray class. NumPy also contains robust methods for manipulating the data in these arrays, as well as a masked and record version. NumPy also contains routines for linear algebra, Fourier transforms, random numbers, and other basic mathematical routines that you'd expect in a core numerical library. One thing I really appreciate about the NumPy project is that they've taken quite a bit of time and have quite comprehensive and well-written documentation, and all of that is available on docs.scipy.org. So we're going to look at this NumPy NVArray class in a little bit of detail to kind of see why it's so special. So an NVArray is a homogeneous strided view on a contiguous block of memory. Now, that's a really big mouthful, so let's break it down. So first of all, an NVArray is homogeneous. This means that each element of the array is the same type and contains the same data. So if we're working with 32-bit floating point data, all your elements of the array are going to be 32-bit floats. If we're working with 64-bit integers, every array element is going to be a 64-bit integer. NVArrays are also a strided view. And what this means is that internally, NumPy keeps track of how many bytes it needs to move over to access the next element along a given dimension. And so for in this example, we have a 3x4 array of 32-bit floating point data. And to move between different columns of the array, we need to move over 4 bytes. To move between rows, we need to move down 16 bytes. And NumPy keeps track of this information. And although this might seem kind of simplistic, NVArrays are also a contiguous block of memory. What this means is there's no gaps. So this strided information is true for every element. And this usually means that the memory is laid out linearly in memory. So although very simple, the NVArray is a very powerful construct because at the core, it's just a memory location with some information about how to access memory or access members of the array. And that memory location can be passed to other languages like C, C++, and Fortran without the need to copy the underlying memory. And so this can really provide an efficient means for doing computations. Also, since we have a strided view, this means that there's some really powerful mathematical functions that can be done just by adjusting the strides. So if we have this two-dimensional array matrix and we want to transpose, so swap the two dimensions, all we have to do is change the order of the strides. We don't have to move anything in memory. By just saying that the memory is accessed in a different location, we now have a different order for the dimensions. So NumPy arrays can be accessed using slicing, and this almost always creates a view of the data, which is in itself a separate NVArray. And to see how this works, if we take our 3x4 matrix and ask for the first row of that matrix, we get back a one-dimensional array with 4 elements, where to move between elements in that array, we have to move over 4 bytes. Something a little bit more complex, if we ask for the first 2 rows and ask for every other element in the second dimension, we get back a 2x2 array where we need to move 8 bytes to access, to move between columns, and we still move 16 bytes to access different rows. In both of these cases, no copying of the data is needed when accessing or modifying these views. And in fact, if you modify the view, the original array is also influenced. So this is really a powerful technique. In PyArt, we make extensive use of NumPy. NVArrays are the primary means of which we use to store numerical data. And just to give you a little bit of flavor of some of the uses, so this is some code that actually converts data from a radar format known as SIGMET, produced by a vendor. And this data comes in as 16-bit integer data. And depending on what type of data that file contains, we might need to convert it. And to do this, we make a lot of use of views to speed up the processing. So if we have differential phase data, we're going to view that data as a set of unsigned 16-bit integers. And then we have to scale it and offset it by an appropriate amount. Some data, though, is actually 32-bit integer data. So again, we can use a view to look at the data in a different way. And none of this requires memory copies. In addition, sometimes the data is actually 1 byte in precision. And so we can use a slightly more complicated view, which I'm not going to try and explain here. But we can basically pull out that data without ever having to make a copy. And then we can perform additional computations. We also use NumPy and PyArt to do some processing. So Nextrad level 3 data uses a compression technique known as run length encoding, where you store a number and then how many times that number is repeated. And in PyArt, we need to decode that data to get back a non-compressed version. To do this, we first read the compressed data from a buffer, and then in Nextrad level 3, the number that's going to be repeated and the number of repeats is actually stored in a single byte. And so we have to pull out those two numbers. And we can do this by using a bitwise AND and then just representing what bits we want to pull out from that data. Finally, we can use the NumPy repeat function, where we provide the number and the number of repeats of that number. And so in the end, we can compress it. And this is very efficient because all of these codes are written in C and quite fast. So another library in the scientific Python stack is SciPy. And SciPy is a collection of mathematical algorithms and functions which build upon NumPy and provides efficient solutions to a number of common numerical tasks in science and engineering. SciPy structurally is divided into sub-packages depending on what type of scientific domain the functions tend to work upon. And these include signal and image processing, interpolation, and spatial data structures and algorithms. There's also functions for performing clustering, as well as numerical integration and differential equations. It also contains a number of fundamental statistics. And there's some procedures to store and access data sparsely in sparse matrices and arrays. In PyArt, we use a number of these functions, including image processing, numerical integration, interpolation, spatial analysis, and sparse matrix storage. And in this example, we're actually looking at velocity data from a radar. And what we want to do in this function is find regions of similar velocities. And the way we accomplish this is with these two lines. So we first pull the array of Doppler velocities, and we basically mark those that are within a given limit. So basically, you know, maybe within 5 and negative 5 meters per second. Then we pass this Boolean array to the label function in SciPy's ndImage subpackage. And this is just a package that does n-dimensional image processing. And this returns this labeled array where regions of connected velocities are labeled with the same number. And this is quite fast, and it's quite powerful, and it doesn't require us to write this low-level code. And so we're very happy with that. So NumPy and SciPy both perform numerical tasks. Sometimes we want to actually look at our data. And so for this, the SciPy stack provides matplotlib, which is a plotting library which produces very nice publication-quality plots. I think there might have been some in some of the keynotes this morning. So it has a comprehensive set of two-dimensional plots, like line, scatter, contour, and pseudocolors. And it can also output to a number of hard copy formats, like PDF, PNG, and JPEG. Matplotlib also provides a limited set of three-dimensional plots. And one nice thing about the package is that these plots can be saved as hard copies, but you can also open up a window and explore your data interactively by zooming and panning. And these interactive plots can also be embedded in an application that you write. So ArtView is a program that actually some collaborators, Nick Guy and Gamma Anderson, wrote that's built on top of Pirate and actually builds a matplotlib figure so that you can explore radar data without ever having to write a line of Python code. In Pyart, we use matplotlib as our only plotting backend. And this allows us to very quickly write short scripts, like this one here, that reads in some data from a radar file and then creates this really nice high-quality plot, which could be included in a journal article. Another package in the SciPy stack is Project Jupyter, which is itself really a collection of various tools and applications for processing data and testing out new ideas in Python. Two of the big pieces of Project Jupyter are the Jupyter console, which is a terminal-based interface for working in Python, and then also the Jupyter notebook, which is a web-based platform where you can explore data and create very rich documents that include figures and formatted text. And both of these interfaces have very excellent integration with matplotlib so that you can include figures. Project Jupyter also ships with some kernels so that you can connect to various programming languages. The ones that are probably most useful here are the IPython, which is interactive computing in Python. But also there's IPy Parallel, which is a lightweight parallel computing platform that integrates very well with the Jupyter notebooks. The project also includes some kernels for working with other languages if you happen to use those. So there's a kernel for Perl, Ruby, R, Julia, and a whole bunch of others. So even if you don't actually want to write in Python, you can use Project Jupyter and the Jupyter notebook as kind of your development environment. Project Jupyter also spun off a number of other interesting tools. So there's a tool to view notebooks. There's a tool to convert notebooks to PDFs and HTML pages. And there's also a tool that allows you to have your students submit a Jupyter notebook as a graded assignment, and then you can grade it and send it back to them. Jupyter Hub is also another kind of new tool out of this that actually allows you to run a server where you serve up Jupyter instances where in a secure environment. So one final library in the Scientific Python stack that I want to look at. Oh, sorry. So we use Jupyter notebooks quite extensively in PyArt. So we do this in our course material. So we often teach some short courses on how to use PyArt. And so we write Jupyter notebooks so that the students who come to these courses can actually look, read about what we're going to do, and then actually execute lines of code. And they get back nice plots that they can look at and examine. And the nice thing is this really allows them to explore the data. Since you do have an interactive computing environment, you can change these lines of code and see the results almost instantaneous. So the last library that I want to talk about is Cython. Cython addresses some of the issues with Python. It allows you to interface with C code, and it also allows you to speed up Python code by adding some static type information. Cython is a Python to C code translator. So you take in Cython files, which are often just Python files, run it through Cython, and this generates a compiled Python module that can be imported. In PyArt, we use Cython for both wrapping libraries and for speeding up code. And as an example, we want to use some functions from NASA's radar software library. So this is a C library that's open source and can read in a number of different radar formats. To do this, we need to write a PDX file, which just contains the definitions from the C headers in a format that Cython can understand. And then we also rewrite this PYX file, which is a Python extension. And this is more or less just just Python code with a few additional syntax that are introduced by Cython. And the real bulk of the work here, and the really exciting part of Cython, is this line here, where we're calling RSL any format to radar. So this is actually a C function, which is going and reading a file, doing the necessary processing, and putting the right things into memory, and then returning back a structure which is understood in Python. So this is really exciting because we can access the C library. In Pyart, we also use Cython to speed up our code. So if we remember back to those labeled velocity arrays, after we label the arrays, we then have to find if for every point in that array, does each point have any of the neighbors in a different region? And if so, we're going to add that to a list to do some processing later. And although this is a pretty easy task, you know, you're just looking at neighbors and comparing a single value, since we have to loop over every element in that array, it's a quite computationally intensive process. And so we rewrote that function in Cython. What we had to do is add some type information, which is these orange syntax or orange additions to the code. And then we also added a couple Cython-specific commands, which are these purple lines. And with these additions, what this function on some test data, which used to take 107 seconds to run, was then, on the same data, took less than a quarter of a second, which is about a 450 speed improvement just by adding, you know, a dozen or so lines. And this is a very small module, under 200 lines of code. So there are a lot of other scientific Python libraries that exist, more than I can really cover in just an hour. And so I would encourage you to look and read about them. But I did want to point out a couple and just touch on briefly that you might find useful and that are often talked about in the literature. So Pandas and X-Ray are both kind of higher level data structures that it can be very useful and also have some functions that are very efficient at working with these data structures. Iris is kind of like Pandas and X-Ray, but it has even more focus on meteorological and climate data. If you want to make plots that include a map, Basemap or Cartopy are the libraries that you'd want to use. And if you want access to those low-level cartographic transforms, PyProj is the library that you're looking for. In meteorology, we often have binary data that is shipped in some specialized file formats, and Python includes some libraries to read those formats. So this includes NetCDF for Python, which can read and write NetCDF files, and H5Py, which is able to access HDF5 files. There's also two libraries that are quite well known in the community and have a pretty large followings. And these are scikit-learn, which is a library for doing machine learning in Python, and also scikit-image, which includes some more higher-level image processing techniques that are probably more focused on images as opposed to just raw data. And as I said, there's many more libraries, more than I can cover in this short amount of time, but I will provide a link that kind of provides another high-level overview of some of these. And so even though there's, you know, with these great libraries, another aspect that really affects the Python is the community, which is very vibrant and growing and really encourages learning and sharing of data. And I think this community really has a large effect on how easy and simple it is to write programs in Python. So a lot of the interactions of this community occur online through a number of venues. These include websites like python.org, which hosts the Python documentation, tutorials, the Python package index, and a wiki. There's also a number of other websites that cover Python. Some of my favorites are scipy.org, which talks about scientific Python stack and has links to all the documentation for those projects. And then there's also Johnny Lin's Python for Atmospheric and Oceanic Science, which includes tutorials and a page that covers a lot more packages than what I was able to cover here, and also information on how you can learn Python. Python also has a presence in social media, so there's accounts on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and even a YouTube channel. And if you're a little more older school, there's also IRC chat rooms if you want to talk in real time. A lot of Python users and developers also blog. Planet Python is an aggregator of all these blogs and is a nice little daily reading to find an interesting article. If you want blogs that are more focused on scientific Python, planet.scipy.org is a nice resource. I also like two podcasts that talk about Python, so Talk Python to Me and podcast.init. And we also like puns in the Python community. So, and finally, a lot of the interactions online of the Python community occur on mailing lists. So nearly all the packages in the scientific Python stack have their own mailing list where users can ask questions and talk to some of the developers of the library. And there's also, as Johnny mentioned, the PyAOS mailing list, which I encourage everyone here to sign up for. So the Python community also meets in person. This is done sometimes at conferences. Some of the big conferences are SciPy, which is an annual meeting that focuses on scientific Python. It's in Austin almost every year, and I believe this year it's July 11th through 17th. There's also PyCon, which is a really big conference which focuses on all aspects of Python. That changes every other year location, but it does occur every year, and I believe this year it's in Portland in, I believe, the last week in May and the first week in August. There's also local conferences like PyOhio, PyTennessee. Fortunately, I'm from the Midwest, so those are the only ones I know about. And there's also specialized conferences on different topics like PyData and this conference here, which is, you know. And one nice thing about the community is if you're not able to make these conferences or you miss a session, a lot of the talks are available online. PyVideo.org is a website that has a lot of these videos, but also you can find them on YouTube or your favorite video website. There's also local user groups, and the Python Wiki has a listing of these, and so you can find one of those and talk to people almost on a monthly or even weekly basis about Python. There's also meetups and hackathons if you want to go write code with other people, and meetup.com has a listing of some of these. Finally, the Python community does have some resources for software developers. So many of the projects have a mailing list specifically focused for development. But that said, there also is some projects choose to just have a single mailing list where both user questions and development conversations occur. There's also two social coding websites, GitHub and Bitbucket. And both of these allow you to post your code and also host issue trackers, wikis, and websites. And I believe there's going to be a short tutorial on how to use GitHub tomorrow. There's also a nonprofit company, NumFocus, which serves to promote the development and use of world-class scientific open-source software. And finally, there are a couple companies which focus on scientific Python, and probably the big names in this are Continuum Analytics, which is probably most well-known for their Anaconda Python distribution, but they've also developed Conda, which is a tool to build and create Python environments, and also Numba, which allows you to speed up Python code and work on GPUs. The other company in this area is nThought, which has their Canopy Python distribution, and they've also developed the nThought tool suite, which is a set of open source libraries that make writing scientific applications very easy. So to give you a little bit of a feel of this culture, I wanted to spend a little bit of time just kind of telling you how I got into Python and how I went about finding my current position. So as a young kid, I was always really interested in computers and technology. I would take apart the computers that my dad brought home from work. And in high school, I started learning about Linux. I installed Linux. I started learning to program. I wrote some C code and made my first contribution to open source while in high school to a project, Project FreeDOS, which is an open source clone of Microsoft DOS. I then went to school at Michigan Technological University, where I majored in chemistry. Here I learned a little bit of web development and some Java, and kind of stayed abreast on what was happening in the open source world. I then went on to do a PhD at The Ohio State University in chemical physics, and this is the first time that I started learned how to write Python. And kind of the reason why I needed to learn this was my advisor gave me some Fortran and C++ codes and said, this is how we're going to analyze this data. And I said, there's got to be an easier way. And so I ended up basically rewriting everything that he had been using in Python. And During that graduate work, I wrote NMR Glue, which is a library for working with NMR data in Python. And at the end of my PhD, I really thought, you know, I really enjoy writing software and I really enjoy science. I'm wondering if I could make a career out of that. And so I looked for a postdoc that would allow me to write some software and continue to develop my skills, but also see if that was something that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And so I did a postdoc at the University of Connecticut Health Center, which allowed me to continue to write programs in Python. And I also did some Fortran development. And most of this work was focused on signal processing in NMR. Also during my postdoc, I attended my first SciPy meeting, which was really an eye-opening experience, and I would encourage anyone who hasn't been to that conference to do it. At that conference, I really saw that there's a big group of people who are really excited and enthusiastic about software and writing high-quality scientific software using Python. It also kind of opened my eyes to the fact that this is something that people can do for their career. And so soon after the Scientific Python conference, I saw a post on the NumPy mailing list that listed a job at Argonne that was going to include a lot of writing of open source Python software. And so I applied, and that's how I ended up getting this advanced algorithm engineer position. And as part of my work, I get to spend a lot of time developing the open source PyArt project, but I also am encouraged to contribute to other libraries in the Scientific Python stack and help users learn about Scientific Python. I also get the opportunity to attend and at sometimes present at some of the big Python conferences like SciPy and PyCon. And I also got involved in the local Chicago area Python community, Chippy. So although that's my story, I think there's really a lot of opportunities to use skills and your Python programming abilities in meteorology and atmospheric sciences. Probably the obvious ones are in high-performance computing and information processing technologies, but I also think there's some that aren't quite as obvious. So any kind of meteorological instrument is going to collect a lot of data, and that data needs to be converted and processed and analyzed to really get meaningful information out of it. And this takes a lot of programming time. If your research interests are a little bit more in simulation and modeling, there's also data assimilation, so taking those observations and producing data that's useful to models. Numerical weather prediction is a huge field that needs really good programmers. And even larger is climate and atmospheric modeling, where although there might be some other languages that you'll have to learn to really get that fast speed, I think Python is still quite useful. But really, regardless of the career you choose, learning Python will really enhance your potential. Because knowing how to program either in Python or another language really opens up a number of opportunities that are not available if you have to depend only on software written by other people. And so with that, I'd like to thank you for your time and attention, and I'm very happy to welcome questions.
For the questions, there is a microphone that was placed right there against the wall. I don't know why it's placed right there. For the recording, if it's possible for you to use that, then the people listening to the screencast later on will be able to hear your question. But if it's a little difficult to make your way over there, that's okay. You can just stand up where you are and ask your question, and Jonathan will also be repeating it for the recording. So questions folks have?
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm not currently a Python user, but I think it would be very helpful to me in my work. I'm a little concerned, though, about what you said about the different versions of Python, the two. Version 2 and version 3 compatibilities. I guess I have two questions. What are the specific enhancements in the version 3, and what do you see as the future?
All right, yeah. So the question was concerning Python 2 and 3. What are the differences, and what do I see as the future? So the major difference that users are going to see between Python 2 and Python 3 is print became a function. And this might seem, you know, a little minor, but you know, you're going to have to change all your print functions. Now, there is automated ways of doing this. Now, lower level, they also changed the way that strings are handled. So strings and Unicode, so basically ASCII versus what everyone else in the world uses, used to be a single, used to be separate objects, and now they're a single object. And so if you're working with bytes, which are slightly different in Python 3, you're going to have to do some work. I should mention, though, it is possible to write code that works in both Python 2 and 3, and that's what a lot of the libraries are using. As for enhancements and why you might choose to use Python 3, it is the future. It's the only version of Python that's currently being developed and new features and bugs getting fixed. If there are, the Python Software Foundation has said that they're going to continue to support Python 2 for a number of years. But if you want to access some cool new features, some of the ones I really like are there's a new async. So if you want to write functions that are going to operate asynchronously, so when an event comes in, there's some nice features in Python 3 that allow that. And Python 3.5 just added a operator which allows you to do matrix multiplication, which is kind of cool if you're going to be doing a lot of linear algebra. So the question was, with Python 3 and some of the new enhances, how do you see, what are some different ways that we're going to use Python?
Yeah.
I don't think there's going to be that much changes that are caused by Python 3. It really was just kind of, as the main developer, so Guido is the creator of Python, he kind of explained Python 3 as fixing some warts that were in the language. So I don't really see a lot of changes. One thing I do like that I don't think I mentioned is if you open a Python shell in Python 3, you now get tab completion, which for some people might be really big. If you use IPython, you've always had tab completion, so it might not matter. Yeah.
There's one term in there, anymore. I don't know what that
yeah. So I used to be a physicist, and that's nuclear magnetic resonance.
The second question is, somebody like me who hasn't touched Python until the short course this weekend, mm-hmm. 2 or 3?
That one's tough. and I mean, I am trying to use, I think really new users should learn 3, because that's going to be the future. Almost all the packages that you're going to use support 3. And if they don't, then you don't use them. As a developer, the problem is I need to support users who still use 2, so I can't always make that switch. But I try and use Python for new development as much as possible, and I really think that's the way the community is leaning, and it's the recommendation now of the Python Software Foundation. So the question was, when will Linux distributions start moving away from Python 2 and start using 3? So it should be said that Python 2.6 is installed in, I believe, CentOS 5 and, or even 6. Okay. Well, the Red Hat maintainers actually say that we as developers should not support 2.6, because if people haven't upgraded, there are ways in, there are methods supported by Red Hat itself to upgrade to 2.7. But the jump to 3 is a little bit more difficult. I think CentOS 7 ships with Python 3. Someone else? 2.7, okay. I do know they have in some of the external repositories, you can install 3, and sometimes if you type Python 3, you get that. So at least for development, you can maybe use it, even though if it's not included as a system default.
What's your favorite Python development environment?
So the question was, what is my favorite Python development environment? So I am a terminal user. And so I use a shell. I edit all my code in Vim or GVim. And I typically have two windows open, a GVim window, and then an IPython terminal. And that's kind of how I run. But I would encourage you to learn an editor. I think I like Vim, but Emacs is just as good. If you like integrated development environments, that's fine too. I just think do spend some time learning some of those features of those, because there's some really cool things, you know, that you can refactor code very quickly and, you know, do search and replaces. And knowing how to do that can really speed up your development time. And a lot of people just, you know, they use something and yet they've never explored some of the features.
I have a quick question about open source contributions. We're here, many of us meteorologists don't really have a lot of background in coding, so our code might not be the neatest or the fastest. But let's say I find a way to do something really interesting that speeds things up, or something that's not really shared out there. How would I go about contributing that code to the community and making sure that, you know, people maybe could contribute to make it faster or better?
So there's the question. Well, I guess it was recorded. So I think it kind of depends on how much involvement you want to get. So if you just have something little that you kind of are like, you know, I'd like other people to know that, oftentimes the mailing list, especially the SciPy mailing list, people just kind of post codes and say, you know, hey, I think this might be useful. And those are archived at a lot of locations. And so, like, I was looking for some wavelet transform code, and, you know, you just Google and you get this mailing post. But if you have something that you think has improved on one of the existing libraries or really is a base functionality, you can try and contribute that back to one of the packages. So the most of the scientific Python packages are on GitHub. And so the method of how you would go and contribute that is known as a pull request, where you clone the repository, make your changes, and then submit it back. And the nice thing is, you know, you're worried, well, weapons, if my code isn't good or something, sometimes kind of annoyingly, but if you submit a pull request, it will get reviewed. And people, usually the scientific community is a little more less harsh than I would say some communities, but you are going to get criticism of your code, and I think you have to just kind of be ready for that and realize that it's for the benefit of everyone. You know, they're trying to help you write better code, and they're also trying to make sure that they produce really high-quality products.
I just want to make a little additional comment, not really a question. The first thing is about Python 2 and 3, there's a package called 6.
Yep.
But try to give you capability for all the script you write in, can execute in both 3 and both 2 and 3. So another thing is called, it's a connection called backports. You try to backport all the exciting Python 3 functions to 2. Personally, I pretty like this package, but it's kind of discouraged by the Python group. So something like it's kind of trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
Just another two additional comments, my personal experience about the Python packages. One is called the Python LLVM. You try to compile Python code into assembly. It's quite very easy to use accelerate package just to find the LLVM function decorator. It's try to compile Python code into assembly language. The LLVM is for the low level virtual machine. It's a general general compile platform. And another thing is called personally, I'm feeling the scikit learning is a very weak machine learning library. So I personally, it's my personal idea, is recommend to use Google Open Source TensorFlow. Okay.
One other comment that I want to make on the Python 2 and 3 debate is you can use both. So if you use Anaconda Python distribution, this actually makes it's really easy. You can create Conda environments for Python 2 and Python 3. And this is personally how I do a lot of my development. If someone says, hey, you know, I'm having a bug, but it only happens in Python 3.3 or 3.4 or something, I'll just switch environments and start working on that. So one option is don't make the choice. Use both. But, I mean, you can only use one at a time, so. Other questions?
If there are no other questions, let's thank our speaker again.